that tells me that there is no secret. Like, there's no secret. We don't live in this hidden. We for sure live in a world where we understand respect for something and the reverence mm-hmm. for something and the care for something. But part of that care is also to be the custodian of it. And in use, discussion is all part of that custodianship. Is that a word?
Yeah.
We're making it. Yep.
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
hoard it.
It's almost like husbandry, right? You know how people use the word husbandry? You know, like animal husbandry. Is there such thing as ceremonial husbandry?
Oh, God. There is now.
It is now.
Welcome to Podcast IRC, conversations with Indigenous scholars to advance understandings and gain new knowledge, hosted by the Indigenous Research Center at Salish Kootenai College. So the belief is that you could give good fortune through names, and that because the name is true, meaning that happened, that good fortune will come to that individual. So like my son's name is Bishkiwalakhba Chilish, which means like fortunate crazy dog, but it's the Crow word for the Marines is the crazy dogs. He was named by my cousin who was in the Marines for 9 years. So he named my son after something he did.
In Blackfoot, our Pikani ideology, there was an event where these Pikani took this Sioux guy and they captured him and they drug him around the camp. And that Sioux, his name was White Dog. So the victory song we use in our Brave Dog Society, we still use that. And the words in there say that this is the day we made White Dog cry. And he was a formidable opponent, and he was well known amongst our people. And over there by, if you can imagine, the Sweetgrass Hills area, there was an encampment there. And my family, in our history, my grandfather was a part of that camp. And they got both sides of the story, and I happened to meet one of White Dog's great-great-grandchildren. And he happened to have his own song about going out on his last time. So back about maybe 5-8 years ago, maybe, those songs met, the song we use for him and the song they have for him. So that was an event for me, but uneventful for Western society because nobody really cares about that nowadays. But those are the types of things that happened in our ways, in our way of life. It's a lot of our ceremonies are based on war, and the words in our ceremonial songs are based on war because it's in times of uncertainty we use those types of things to help us.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting what you said about, you know, the use of some of these things during times of uncertainty, you know, especially during battles, you know, when you're seeing loss of life, you know, sometimes we talked about it in one of our episodes about this romanticism, you know, and people who aren't attuned to, you know, the events of the past. And, you know, you can read about these battles and the number of deaths, you know, but if you're not experiencing that death and that responsibility that comes with mourning, the responsibility that comes with making sure your loved ones are laid to rest appropriately. I mean, that's a pretty big deal, you know. It's not just a fanciful story, you know, that you read in a Western. These are real lives with real people dying. So you can just imagine the songs that would be needed in those times of uncertainty.
Right.
When I was just thinking about there was one of our last battles was, I think, in around 1883, some Salish who were on a buffalo hunt over in around a mussel shell stole some horses from some crows. And so, you know, the crows, of course, followed the camp and recovered their horses and had a big old battle. And this is in 1883. Well, then here, fast forward a year later, you got these Salish visiting the crows and acquiring the grass dance songs to bring back to their people. So no more than a year later, you know, it was just a common occurrence, these battles and then making peace. You know, it was just part of the daily process of life, where holding grudges and those kind of things was handled in a different way, you know.
Tribal people believe in verifying an event. That's like an important thing, the witness, you know. So someone's not going to make a song about crazy sister-in-law if they can't verify that what they're going to sing about happened. Just like the White Dog song, if there's no witness to that, they're not going to speak about it. So sometimes the witness had to be even the other person, other tribe, or the enemy, what we call the enemy tribe. Even though I've researched that topic a lot, and I don't buy into this idea necessarily that there was hatred or, you know, and all this. It just seemed like they make it sound like we fought constantly. It's more about the deed as opposed to the battle. So like, I know many instances where two tribes would fight each other. They didn't consider it necessarily victory if the tribe came back and said, oh, we wiped them out, or we beat them, we won. Who came home with deeds?
Yeah.
You know, the group might have lost the battle, but did people come home with deeds? And that was celebrated, you know.
When you have our ceremonies, you have to have 4 coop stories before you can eat. And eating is part of one of the main things that happen in there. But the coup stories, when you translate coup story, it just means a gun. Namaka. It means a gun. But what it means is that you're touching the enemy without getting hurt. You're escaping some kind of danger. And that's pretty much, you want to have a lot of coup stories so that when you're in those ceremonies, you can recount those and it's kind of a venue to brag almost, but it's they're necessary. Probably the late 80s, not many people would go to our ceremonies. So there was very limited people. And at that time, there wasn't really any war. You know, there was no war happening. But in his conceptual worldview, he would say, you have to talk about war. You have to talk about escaping danger. But nobody really went to war, so we had to adjust. And education was one of them, and hunting stories were another of them, or sports, if you were involved in a victory. So a lot of those took the place of outright battle. And one of the questions that is on the list tonight is what is knowledge? And how do we get that knowledge? How is it acquired? The epistemology or the ontology of how we get that. Is it different? Is Blackfoot different from Crow, from Salish, from Kootenai, from Nez Perce? You know, each one of those has their own processes.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey. where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
I mean, there's always more to talk about it. There's a lot. We have barely touched it. And, you know, this idea of knowledge, you know, is a pretty important one, because that's what a research approach is trying to do. You know, it's trying to create some new knowledge. And there has to be some pathway to verify whether the knowledge is true or not. So, really, if you think about knowledge, you know, as kind of a manifestation of some high level of skill, or the manifestation of a person overcoming an obstacle to reach a certain what you might call success. If you think of it in that way, you know, songs really are, especially these kind that we're listening to, are really a piece of data or a piece of validation of someone's knowledge that they had gained, whether it's you know, a success in battle, or maybe it's as Aaron was saying in the beginning, a manifestation of some spiritual power that follows that song, that really becomes a really valid piece of knowledge in those times. You know, whether or not it's still valid today, whether it still can be used in academics in a different way, that's kind of the question. I think we have a good understanding of how to gain knowledge in a tribal way, you know, especially in the ways you're talking about, the spiritual way. But then to shift that into academics, that's the tough one. That is the tough one.
And then again, the defining, who's doing the defining of native knowledge? And like I said, it's the process of how you would attain that epistemology of going out seeking knowledge through a vision quest, through transfer of songs, transfer of power from one entity to another. Like I said, we still have that in place for Blackfoot people. And I know Crow people have that. And I know Kootenai people have that. But not a lot of tribes have that nowadays, which brings me to that question again. Well, if we're going to say we're this Indian or that Indian, or we're Indian or Native or Indigenous, how do we know this? How do we know? What's the validation on that part as well? You know, does that make sense?
We're in a weird time, like a pretty delicate time when it comes to ceremony, song, social structure, kinship. It all plays into a part of an identity, but it seems to me that if you were to approach the average Native person and say, who are you and how do you know? The instinct right away is to kind of be on the defense. Now, when you approach culturally competent individuals, that question doesn't come to them as offensive. Now, I don't know if I'm wrong for thinking that, or if I'm kind of out in left field with the way I'm thinking. It's just in my experience, when you talk about things like that, and when you try to address that idea, it goes immediately to enrollment, right? Or immediately to like, well, I grew up again.
As a product of all of these things, but we're making a resurgence And it's very evident when you have an indigenous research center talking about these issues again. So the collective agreement is not lost. It's out there in the ether. How you attain that via tribal college, Crow, Little Bighorn, Blackfeet, Salish Kootenai College, you know, that's where you would begin your quest for that. But when you start to get into who am I type thing, it's there. I mean, there's elders that still exist that speak the language and have knowledge of those ceremonies for times of uncertainty. It's just like hand game songs or love songs. They're meant to mesmerize the opponent or your the person you're trying to seek out still has power.
Yeah. I was going to say, so it seems like the job of Native people today is to create the environment where these songs can thrive or where this type of thing can thrive. Not necessarily wait to say, well, when this song is relevant again, I got it and I'm going to bust it out. It seems like part of our job is to create it, to create the environment mm-hmm. for it. We can't just rely. So that brings us back to tribal college. Does the tribal college play a role in creating that environment? Now, I'm not speaking specifically for our college or any individual college, but I've run into this so much where people say, I don't feel like I'm qualified. Right. I've run into this a lot. I know you've run into this. So for years I have been doing like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And one time I was going to get my purple belt. Right. And I said, oh man, I feel like I'm not a purple belt yet, you know? And then my instructor said, if it was up to the student to decide if he was ready, he would either be a black belt on day one or he'll never achieve black belt. So it's not the job of the individual to say, am I qualified or unqualified? Yeah. I feel like it's the group. That's what makes us tribal. We're a group. Yeah. We do it as a group. And if the group sees you as qualified, then you got to step up. Otherwise, you know,
it has to be within certain people's purview of things that they deem important. And through the history of, you know, the history of Indian people getting, you know, culture and things stamped out of us, you know, some people aren't privileged to have that as their driving force, or they don't understand, you know, what is the thing that's going to motivate the right people to do the right thing at the right time. So you default to what you know. And if all you know is something that's largely been non-native or, you know, partially, then that seems to be one of the challenges with leadership anywhere for that matter.
Knowledge. But even our chief, who's our hereditary chief, he'll tell you, I don't know everything. And if you feel that you can have a different story, I'll come up here and correct me, please. He said, I wish those older people were here to hear my story so they could validate what I'm saying. How about this concept? Go ahead, when Mike. You write a proposal and you write it in a Western society sense and then an afterthought, hey, let's put culture in it, a culture component.
Yeah.
Right there, you've already failed.
Yeah. You know how many times we've had this conversation, especially me and Shandin, are you like,
yeah,
well, you guys have to define, how we're going to put a cultural component into this. It's like, all right, we're already lost.
Yeah.
But it's shown in our language that we could talk about those things in great detail, and it's part of the framework of what it means to be Blackfoot or Pikunni or Kootenai or Salish or Crow. It's there. You have to bring it out somewhere. And the tribal college should be that venue to do that.
I'd be good for it, but it's that fine line between, you know, what authority does that institution have over rites and rituals that are held by the community. Mm-hmm. Not that they would have the you know, possession over it, but just like Western academics is just kind of goofy, you know. If you write something while you're employed as a as a university a professor, then all those things that you produce there are property of the university, and
that's an odd thing. It's the museum mentality.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, and you see it, it surfaces in the tribal college system as well. You know, you got policies and it's the same darn thing. So that's kind of the cautionary step, I guess, that, you know, community members have, at least around here. And they have it also, they also hold that true with the tribal government, because they say that's just a pseudo government. It doesn't represent a true tribal way of getting things done. It's just you guys all are familiar with the IRA and all those kind of things.
Just because you had an experience, because something happened, that isn't necessarily knowledge. That doesn't count. Sure, it happened. All right. But unless somebody else is, like you're saying, going to verify that, to say, yeah, that happened, and I think maybe we share an understanding about what that means. We've got a common perspective that, like, there's some consensus about not just what happened, but, you know, how to think about that, what to do about that. And so, I mean, that is a big deal, right? And I don't think that that's something that we, like you're saying, SKC, Western academics, we don't talk about that kind of stuff. It's just, what's knowledge? Well, it's what I tell you in class.
And this is what Maslow brought out in his study, is how he got that model was how he viewed how the Blackfoots taught their children. They had a lot of reverence for their children. They didn't tell them to be quiet or to be seen and not heard, or, you know, vice versa. So the difference was the pedagogy of how they taught. And again, when you're trying to conquer people, you know, you're going to feed them what they need to know and what they don't need to know. So that's the dichotomy that we live in of these two conceptual worldviews. They don't match. And that the side of the ideology of what it means to be whatever tribe you say you are, it's being pushed back. It's being regulated to after five on Wednesdays, or on Saturday, doing anything we'll have our doings. They're still practicing those ways that have been here for thousands and thousands of years. They're still singing the songs that have been here for thousands of years. They're just doing it in the time frame that doesn't fit. And I always talk about Indian time in my classroom settings. And a lot of people think Indian time is whenever we begin, when everybody gets there, we'll begin, that everybody's lazy and we'll get there. But it's very precise, because when you have like Savas berries are only available at a certain time of the year for a couple of weeks at a time. And if you don't have those berries, your ceremony is shot for the year, plus your food source is shot for the year. So you have a limited amount of time to gather those. But there's so much more to knowledge, indigenous knowledge, that we need to, this venue needs to put out there more, so that people could say, hey, they're talking about this again. Let's go find out more about it. It kind of plants that seed. That's what I hope this does.
Listening to everybody discuss things, one thing that I really have taken from this conversation, and I think more people need to embrace it, is that We're all tribes, and we're all tied together more than I think people like to admit. You know, I think they have this concept of we're enemies and this is your territory over here and, you know, this is yours over here. But as hearing you guys talk about, like, song and dance and Bitterroot and things like that. It's like we're so much more tied together. I mean, we're all very separate and have our own customs, but I just really feel like we're tied together more, and I wish more people would start to embrace that a little bit more. So,
but yeah, for this conversation, I think the one thing I started thinking about was in terms of knowledge, and we're talking about acquiring knowledge. I also am trying to think of like there's a purpose to having knowledge. And you know what, and that might mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people, and depending on what knowledge it is that you're gaining. But you know, I guess I tend to think that there's a deeper meaning for some of this knowledge that we're talking about acquiring. And I'm also really sensitive to the fact of misusing knowledge at any point in time. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So I'm just, yeah, like those are just the two points I'm kind of thinking about, and how our center can, we talked about it before too, about intent, like what's your intent with the knowledge that we're acquiring? Maybe that relates to this point on the purpose and what we can use our knowledge for today in these very different times.
A lifelong, I've been involved in my ceremonial ways. And again, they're not academic, but because I live it, I thought it would be a really good idea for myself to research out songs, you know, shed some light on songs, because songs are the physical documentation of permission. They're that valid. So like, I think one of the ladies was talking about having the song sung at graduation. That's the perfect venue for, as opposed to getting a piece of paper. If someone were to sing your song, that's equal, if not better. If in 100 years, all of us on this podcast are going to be an ancestor, what are they going to say about us? Did they perpetuate this way of life, or did they just talk about it type thing? I always throw it at students, you know, to get them to think.
To get them to act. Yeah, for sure. That's—
Western society, and how right now we're in Western society thinking, and we're building capacity for Western society, but the capacity for Native thinking has always been here, and it's been here longer than any other conceptual worldview. And we're really not looking at that in a scholarly way. And with your Indigenous Research Center, it's giving us that opportunity to talk about our ways. And we talked about last time, we talked about who cares. I mean, the average Joe American doesn't really care about this kind of history. But in this group that's attending this podcast, that's on this podcast, they do care about that, because that's our history. That's our way of thinking, in that dichotomy of those two different worldviews coming together and conflicting event. But songs in general, from my experience, they're the key that opens up that door to that other side that we don't talk about with our five senses. And that other sense that's out there, you can open that up. You
know, we like I think I mentioned before, we're always looking into the past for guidance, for things that we need to do today. And, you know, as we all know, our world's really, you know, kind of upside down, the way that our ancestors lived even 50 years ago, even 30 years ago, for that matter, in some instances. And, you know, the challenge that I see in all of this, you know, number one is really promoting the importance of songs as the things that you've already mentioned and that we've talked about before. how they're a particular connection to things that are unseen. But they really are markers, and they're records of occasions and events, and they're I think wholly underutilized today by Native people in a traditional sense. So
right.
The biggest challenge I see with doing all of that is how do we make it part of our daily routine, and not, like you said last in the podcast, not just after five.
Right.
Deeds that are accomplished today, how do we equate those respectfully or comparably to what would merit the singing or the transfer of those songs?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what, you know, there's a lot of things that would have to occur first. You know, number one, we have a very small pool of people who understand and know songs and music in that context. And then number two, you know, in the modern times, how do we apply that to events that doesn't cheapen it, you know? Because if you think about it, in the olden times, going off to battle and surviving or touching your enemy, that's life and death kind of stuff. That's not really what mm-hmm. we deal with today, unless you're talking about surviving a mm-hmm. drive down 93, you know.
Sure.
You know, it's just one of those things, you know. How do we equate that while maintaining the integrity of that process? Mm-hmm.
Brought up, you know, when people say like with education, we're modern warriors, and then I'm kind of uncomfortable with that statement when people say that to me, because people will say like,
yeah,
you got your degrees, you know, it's like you're a modern warrior, and I'm like, well, no, because there's still people who go to war. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's that's still a testable feat, and still there's still the collection of deeds. So I get real uncomfortable with that. I know when people use that to me, and I can't speak for everybody. So I think when you say, well, what's a comparable deed? I think we have to acknowledge that the comparable deed is still that deed.
In that way, would graduating high school be a worthy deed? Graduating college, would that be a worthy deed?
Well, I think it's their deeds, their accomplishments, yeah. But are they on the level of composing songs for you, or singing these songs for you? And I think one way to show success in any deed is irregularity too, right? Things that don't happen as much, and then you prove that you can do it. So you stand out, right? So like,
yeah, so
but I'm also not the authority on this, so I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, who is? Who is?
Mm-hmm. Someone needs.
We want to know.
Someone needs to jump in here now and say yeah. I'm in the weeds here, man. Yeah. I think. Well, and then, and okay, so here's the next question: what if you've done something well enough, worthy enough for someone to say, we're going to have a song composed for you. Okay. So now who's going to do that? That's a whole, now you're going into a whole nother yeah. skill. So I think ultimately the people who will compose songs for people's success have to be the people who sing. You're still subject to the people who control that occupation. So, this idea of then who has the right to do that? Who has the right to compose a song for another person? Who has the right to seek it or whatever? And so what does that mean? What does right mean?
What I do want to say is that last week I was talking to Janine Pease. She serves on my dissertation committee. And I had a finding in there that said loss of culture. And she didn't say that I should change it, but she gave me all of this evidence that we aren't losing our culture. Our culture is very much alive. And one of the things she said to me was, you know, our culture, it's evolving. It evolves with the times. And I hadn't ever really heard that before, or maybe I had, and I just didn't have anything to apply it to. And so in thinking about this question, I'm also thinking about what Janine said to me. And yeah, I might not have the right to give anything away or even really understand that process. But I also, what I do have the right to do is learn about it and make sure that we do talk about it so that, you know, so that it doesn't go away. So those are all my
something. Not realizing that as I learned, as I got older and I went to school and I educated myself, and that everyone has culture. The way the word is understood now is defined, is that everyone has 100% of culture. It's not yeah. This thing that's fractionalized. It's all of us have 100%. So in Selena's comment, what Janine said to her, yeah, that's 100% right. Culture can't shrink or grow. It is what it is. Now, where that as an organism, where culture can change and fluctuate, is each within that organism, there's these little like pie pieces, I guess you can say, but it's still 100% of it, right? So when Selena made the comment about what Janine had said about culture not dying out, she's right. Culture doesn't die out, right? As long as humans move, culture exists. The natural evolution of culture is completely warranted and it's accepted. And even from tribes all across the plains, they accepted a natural evolution of culture, right? And we know that through oral history, and that's called stratified narrative. And you can see it in story, right? It's like each time that evolution happens, it adds a new layer to the narrative of a people. So
yeah,
when this evolution happens unnaturally, that means you have to mitigate it with an unnatural remedy, because the natural remedy can't account for that. So
yeah,
so that's where I would argue, Selena, with Janine a little bit in the most respectful way possible. I would tell her that she's right. 100% the culture of Crow people is not dying. But how that evolution happened is not natural and it's unsafe. You're right. And that's where to go back to an earlier podcast, that's where that romantic version of ourselves is dangerous, because we as Indian people have replaced authentic forms of culture with things that are dressed up as culture. Yeah. And because we only have the capacity to have 100% of culture, when that new thing comes in, it has to push something out or stamp it out.
Yeah.
It's like stuffing a fire too thick, right? It needs that to breathe. So people don't understand that even these practices as harmful to culture, like the peyote religion. And I grew up around it a little bit, so I'm not going to dog it or anything, but I can see how people can say, well, that can come in. It's masked as something of your own. And it could hurt. So you can see that with other things. Powwow can do that. It's masked as something that's authentically ours. And it could. So when these methodologies come into play and doing research,
yeah,
and people mask them with medicine wheels and feathers and God's eyes and safety pin headdresses. Or they say, hey, this is the talking circle and all these things. I'd like to think that those, even if they're meant well, that's still, it's dangerous to introduce new things like that that can take off like a knapweed, you know?
The word metonymy comes to mind when you think there's no substitute for that. There's no substitute for sweet pine or sweet grass or juniper. It's that. Whereas you look at the cross, that's euphemism for the church, right? You think Christianity, Jesus.
Yeah.
There's no replacement for those things. It's that. So in there,
the thing Aaron was talking about the, you know, we have 100% of our culture. It's the practices and the traditions that die off, but there's always this desire or this human endeavor to keep that cultural piece whole. So there's always something that comes in and replaces it. And what we were really curious and wondering about is what is that thing that drives us to want to keep a piece of culture alive, or I guess a piece of the practice alive, to a point where we evolve it to fit the modern day today. So. Brings up this really strange occurrence where people will self-proclaim themselves as being the ones to know. And that's pretty far outside of a tribal way of thinking, to be self-appointing yourself a knower of things. So, mm-hmm. and you see this in academics, you see it in native faculty who adhere to some of those values, where the pathway to promotion and success in academics really requires a person to have a degree of self ability to self promote, and a lot of folks just can't do that, and in a way, that leaves us behind some of our non-native colleagues in a way. But, I think there's something more, and there's something for us folks like that. It just hasn't been realized yet. And the tribal colleges are kind of leaning toward that, but, not quite there yet. So this idea of rites and rituals and who knows and who gets to do what can be kind of a contentious subject to talk about in certain communities.
In the Blackfoot thinking, no being is better than another being. Mm. So like the animals that walk on the water, or on the ground, or the under the water, or under the earth, or in the air. And then human beings are not better than in any of the animals. So they have to ask for permission. And through that permission is that song. That song is the validation of permission. So in our belief, that song is very important. And if that song disappears from our culture, it'll still exist somewhere in the ether. But if it's not practiced, that type of knowledge can't be gained, or that kind of power can't be gained, because the song is not there. Mm-hmm. After I went to school and I came back to my community, I sat down and probably about 2016, 20 years ago, I just sat down and looked in my community, who could sing a song without having any help or a recorder, or would know someone's song or something's song without having any help. And I made a list of all the elders. Then I made a list of all the middle age. Then I made a list of all the young people, and then the really young people. Hmm. That list that of the elders, they're all gone except for maybe four. So that knowledge is almost gone if somebody doesn't go out there and ask. And I think.
But yeah, what is. That's really good. That's a really good one there, is when you think about that. I think that's a good, like, a test of where a tribal group is, who, like you said, who can sing a song, very traditional song that has a very specific purpose without any help, knows the processes and the protocols. I think that's a really good test of where a person might be. And it might really give us an avenue to say, okay, this is, if this is really important, if the songs are really important to anything tribal in a community, how can we use the vehicle of research then to propagate that or to disseminate that into mm-hmm. the community? Mm-hmm. That's a tough one, because you have to have open-minded people to say, you know, yeah, I want to know, how do I do this?
Yeah.
And sometimes the block, the major block that I see sometimes is somebody saying, oh, you know, you're not right. That's mm-hmm. not the way we do it, because this is what so-and-so said. Even if they're wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you get in this battle of who's more right, or, you know, who's more traditional in
their how it's done. But what I've boiled it down to is the transfer process itself of having a venue, having action, having language, and having song.
Yeah.
No matter what is being done, is if you followed that process, that's what I think is a Blackfoot thing. Is if you follow that process, and that's how you would get the knowledge transferred to you. And it may be different for the same types of things, but as long as you follow that protocol, it's valid.
Making mistakes, but doing it wrong and being corrected, because really that's the only way you learn.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that in the research process. Like, that's exactly how I learned to do my research, right? I went and tried to do it, and if I was wrong, somebody corrected me. And I wasn't afraid to do it wrong. So I wonder why we're so hesitant to do, well, I shouldn't say I wonder why. I think we're more hesitant to do that with our own cultural practices because if we do it wrong, like just all of the other things that go along with it, like we're sometimes we're known for doing it wrong for the rest of our lives, you know, oh yeah, she's the one that, you know, did whatever.
She's always screwing up.
These ways are really powerful. And if you don't do it correct, you can hurt somebody, mm-hmm. yourself, your family, or somebody else. So that notion of you be careful what you say, you can hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. You be careful what you do. Think of your children. So that's why it's so important that we do those things correctly. And because a lot of our generations have been removed, they understand that. So they look at it from afar and say, those are powerful. I better not mess with that.
Yeah.
I better not mess around with that stuff. And as a result, they stay away. I'm just assuming that's what some people do, but
you know, when you can take a baby and you can hug it, and you can hug it so much you can kill it. And the way I see Crow people today is we live in a world where we think we're loving something so much, but really what we're doing is stamping it out. Crow creation story. So there's like conceptual ideas that keep ideology alive. They keep worldview alive in simple, simple terms. But by changing those terms, you unknowingly hurt things. Like what Mike was saying, be careful what you say, you know. And so when we say Akbarak Dia, man, I would never tell any Crow that they're wrong for using that word.
Yeah.
But they have to understand that that word encompasses a whole different worldview. Now, I've seen a revitalization of culture in the right direction among a very small group of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where I've seen the loss of elders. I've seen the loss of language. But I've also seen the loss of antiquated ideas too. And I've seen the loss of old pedagogies that serve no purpose. I've seen that die out. And I've seen a growth, although albeit small, but of culturally competent tribal people, like people.
But there is an importance to ask our elders and ask those cultural experts about the future and about their ideas of how our culture will look in the future. So I think hearing all this discussion today and trying to be a part of it, which we kind of discussed before. It's a pretty hard thing. I think that's one acknowledgement that we should make is cultures change, and we should ask elders and cultural experts about what they think our culture will be changing into in the future.
I don't know if I have a solution, but I think where we start is this, where we just talk about what are our hesitations, what are the connections, what are things that are already being practiced that work and what doesn't, and we just keep talking about it.
Yeah, that's and I think we have to be unafraid to challenge what's fed to us. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a lot of material out there that people are producing, and it's infiltrating into things that are deemed indigenous. And whether we agree or disagree, I think we have to be able to be brave enough to say we disagree or we agree. But I think the next step for really on the ground natives, you know, working hard in our communities on the res or communities in urban environments is starting to get these ideas out there in whatever format we can. So we can get some validation, as Mike talked about, to validate from our community, to have some accountability, to know that what we're saying is right or whether it's wrong, and be able to have the humility to say, yeah, okay, I see how I'm wrong, and what can we do next?
With this day and age, not that many people, I feel like they're too preoccupied with other things. You know, and they're not making their culture a priority, and they're not getting involved, and they're not learning these things. And so I feel like if people keep on talking about it, it sparks an interest. And when that happens, you know, they might want to reach out. So I just feel like the more we talk about it, the more people start to think about it. So that's kind of what my thoughts are.
You know, I don't think it's our job to tell people to be more cultural or to be more Indian, I guess. But what I would tell people is if that's what you're choosing, is not to be part of the movement of revitalizing culture and worldview, is don't be in the way.
Mm-hmm. And
it's weird because we live in a weird time where, like, Indian people, there are Indian people who actively get in the way of cultural progress.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's fine. That's their right. They can do that. But I would say if that's the route you want to go, don't get in the way of anyone else, I guess, that's choosing that way. And another thing that I always get worried about with Indian people, because I've done it myself, is don't replace the preservation of culture and identity with another movement thinking it is that.
Yeah.
And I see that with activism, and I see that with other things. Not to say that that's bad, but what I would advise young people that are growing in culture is it's real easy to cross the line and become more of a social justice warrior, and then you'll sacrifice time learning the very thing you're trying to protect.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. And to learn more, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at IRCSKC. You can find us also on Facebook and YouTube by searching SKC Indigenous Research Center. You can also visit our website at irc.skc.edu. Don't forget to join us next time as we continue our discussions on Indigenous research, Indigenous research methodologies, and Indigenous worldviews.